Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
On Friday, October 16th, the Norris Group proudly presented its 8th annual award-winning black tie event, I Survived Real Estate. An incredible lineup of industry experts joined Bruce Norris to discuss perplexing industry trends, head-scratching legislation, and opportunities emerging for real estate professionals. Proceeds from the event benefited Make-A-Wish and St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. This event could not have been possible without the generous help of the following platinum partners. First Lending Solutions, Housing Wire, the Apartment Owners Association, the San Diego Creative Real Estate Investors Association, Invest Club for Women, MVT Productions, Property Radar, the San Jose Real Estate Investors Association, and White House Catering.
Leslie or Sean, the water issue, that's, one of the things, I'm very suspicious of radical elements on either side of a fence, to be honest with you. But this is sort of like a real drought, and it seems like there's a real chance to say, okay, well, here are the rules, and we're going to fine you a whole bunch of dollars if you don't do stuff. And I start to be concerned about the building industry just being told you can't build anything new because that's going to use water. Sean, are you concerned at all that type of mood could reach into the investor world and say, okay, well, you have a rental that there's water on the sidewalk and they have a system where you get told on. That's my concern, is the investor might be the target, sort of like the tall grass thing that we got some vines on. So just any input on
why not?
Why not?
I don't mean that it should, but I mean that certainly seems to be the mentality. I mean, on the affordable housing thing, how anybody thinks housing in California can be more affordable by adding fees to new housing for affordable housing? You're increasing the cost of housing to make affordable housing. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense.
And when you can have that, it was our Supreme Court in the state of California that opined on that, and we're appealing it to the U.S. Supreme Court.
So, I mean, to the degree that you have that kind of, inane argument that in order to have affordable housing, we need to add fees to housing, it just doesn't pass the smell test on logic scale, right? Can you have other ridiculous arguments? I think absolutely. I think we're going to face lots of them.
I just want to add here, though, I think it's great and fine and you can point the finger at government, but I think the whole not in my backyard attitude is a huge part of the issue. And anyone that drives the freeways in Southern California, I think, has every right to feel that we can't have one more housing unit in Southern California, right? But this isn't rocket science. There are global capitals with examples galore. It's high-density development along viable transportation corridors. And unless you're going to have a one-child rule or deal with population growth in another way, you've got to get rational about new construction. Because I'll tell you what's going to happen. Part of the explosion that David was going to talk about in the market in 4, 5, and 6, 8 years is not going to happen in California. It's happening in Texas and Denver and Seattle and Portland, because that's where the young families can go and actually buy affordable housing. They're not going to be able to do it in Southern California. And I think that's a real shame. Eileen's at Tejon Ranch. You're not dealing with existing homeowners, but developers that are. I mean, let's face it, CEQA is the go-to place for I'm going to sue and stop this development, So it's also us, It's not just the environmentalists and not just the government. It's the public not really being able to envision a different future.
May I add one thing?
Yes, sure.
One thing I think I can say is if
if we're successful at Tejon Ranch, we will have affordable housing, but it wasn't for some sacrifice. And one place we didn't get to was, you know, sure, we signed this agreement that says we're going to set aside 90% of our land for the environment. But what we did was what we did in that is we got those five nationwide environmental groups to say they would stand down in a CEQA process. So they're not going to challenge our developments. And if they do anything near that, we can, you know, knock them down and stop them from that. So we will be able to develop these areas without being nickel and dimed to death by these environmentalists. But I mean, we didn't give up land over it, but we gave up the ability to develop our other future land holdings as a result.
But, I mean, at the end of the day, there's places in Texas where you can build a house for the cost of a permit in certain places in California.
That's right.
Which is pathetic, yes.
So if you want to address affordable housing and that type of thing, I completely agree with Leslie. You also have to think about infrastructure. And nobody – I live in Tahoe. You want to talk about a not in my backyard. You know, we recently – we're trying to build a school up there right now. And, you know, we've got folks in one of the highest-end communities living on a golf course, which, you know, golf's great, but it's not like a really, you know, sound environmental use of land, I don't think. And, you know, and here they are with their golf course home saying, well, we don't want you to develop this land. Well, that land was entitled for a school. We're not asking for a zoning change or anything else. It's been entitled for a school forever. And they're saying, no. I'm saying, well, okay, how about I show up with the bulldozer at your house tomorrow and let's convert that back to wilderness first? I mean, it is, to Leslie's point, it's not a reasonable argument this, you know, if a piece of land is entitled and should be allowed, it should be able to be built. And we've got a second guessing of that on everything, and that just adds a lot of cost to the process. So maybe we need to put our hands up and say, look, do-over. We're going to think about the master plan here and kind of re-entitle everything and come up with some sort of compensation for those people who gain and the people who lose. But this current situation where you've got people with land that's properly zoned and entitled having to face years, there's one folks that just trying to get develop some property in Truckee. They've been at it for 20 years.
Wow.
Trying to get their property entitled. And the folks aren't wealthy. You know, they're not doing well. It's not some rich developer. You know, they have this gift of some land, but they can't do anything with it. And 20 years, that's not fair. That's not right.
No. During the break, I was it was suggested I ask a question, and it's all in our best interest. A lot of the people in the audience are risk takers, investors. They use leverage. And so they're very interested in the panel's take on, do we have a bubble forming, or are we at that point where we have some concern about prices declining from here? And I'll open that to anybody that wants to take it on first. And I'm gonna add some elements to that as we go through the question or the answer of the question. So
okay, well, I'll start, and I'll just say never say never. The homes that are being bought today are being purchased by people with real incomes, real down payments, real money, and as we've noted earlier, they're getting real mortgages with fairly strict underwriting. So the things that were happening that kind of led up to the, you know, 2007, 2008 meltdown are really not in play, but it doesn't mean that things couldn't happen that would impact housing prices. For example, are equities overvalued? You know, some people would say absolutely yes.
Okay.
Are all of the companies in Silicon Valley that are providing, you know, these incredible gains to their employees, is that sustainable? Do their valuations make sense? And what happens if there were a big adjustment, which is possible? So there are kind of ripple effect things that could happen. But in terms of it coming from kind of inside, like rotting from the inside, I don't think we have those conditions today.
Okay.
Can I offer a
bubble might be, let's say, the end of a pricing cycle and not be accompanied by a crash necessarily. But that's what you're saying. There's none of that
Right, and understand, you know, I mean, I think it's great to focus on rates, but, you know, you've also got 25% of the market all cash or whatever the, you know, number varies from area to area. So that's a little higher than we've typically seen.
Okay.
I was going to give a reading assignment to go along with the quiz.
Okay.
John Williams, the president of the San Francisco Fed, wrote it, and it's on their website, something called an economic newsletter. It's basically a speech that he did, where the title is Monetary Policy and House Prices. And so if you, it's about 6 pages long. It doesn't have any equations in it. And otherwise, I wouldn't be referencing it. You know. But inferentially, he asked the question, if you believe that the price of an asset is the net present value of its discounted cash flows, then given where interest rates are, do you think asset values are overvalued?
Okay.
So that's it's worth reading and thinking about that, because that's that would be the interest rate play.
Sean and you and I were talking about in the limo where you had a San Francisco house that was, what, $3.5 million, and it was a rental value of $6,500. Then we equated that the tax value of that house had to have a tax bill of whatever.
It was half the rental income.
Half of the rental income, so his net yield was 1.5%.
Yeah, no, it's definitely a little crazy in the valley again.
Okay.
You know, I think big picture on this bubble question, I think one thing we have to keep in mind is that homes are less affordable today than they were in 2006.
And explain, right?
The basic definition of affordable is how many people can afford a home today. In 2006, anybody with a pulse could afford a home. You know, the stat says that we had 17% affordability, but really, what do we have? You know, 80% affordability in 2006? There's no question that homes are less affordable today and that we are more overpriced given lending terms and income than we were in 2006.
Now,
so
you're really
how
hurting
do you define
me.
A bubble?
That's one of the things I count on is that affordability chart. And Sean and I bounce this around this week. So I look at that affordability chart. It has similar endings, and you've all heard me discuss that. And one of the things that I definitely was concerned about is you could have a very different affordability this time because of just saying no to so many people and the inability to make price progression. We also have some other elements that are kind of in play for the first time. The bulk buyers, the single family conglomerates, if they decide to exit, I'm just curious, are we concerned about them being market makers as they go out as they were as they came in? Any takers on that one?
I'll just jump in from this standpoint, which is, you know, after that period of inflation that Doug, you know, referred to earlier, we hit a point where we were very used to high interest rates. And through that period of inflation in the late 70s, we pretty much wiped out debt. And that allowed us to grow the economy for the last 35 years now through cheaper debt. And by growing the economy, I think mostly through the growth of debt. And we've hit the zero bound of that. And what does that mean? I think there's a much bigger issue at play here than just the housing cycle. And I think you have to start putting things in that context. If you look at Japan, where I think, 1.5% 35-year mortgage, am I roughly right there, is the standard? If we're headed into that kind of environment because of these bigger picture issues, we can't raise interest rates. We have too much national debt. How do we pay that back without accelerating deficit, you know, making things worse? So if we're now in a permanently low interest rate environment, will we look back 5 years from now and go, you know what, 2%, 3% return on a house looks pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
So I, on the one hand, I think we're less affordable than ever and more of a bubble than ever. On the other hand, I think in this kind of environment, if they don't, you know, lose the game, and we stay in this low interest rate environment, it could get worse or better, depending on what you want to see happen.
Do we have any concern? This is one of the things that's been brought up here all the time when I speak, is the concern about the maturing of the equity lines. where there people are now going to have to start paying on the equity line and not have access to it, but now it's turning into a 15-year loan. So are there enough of those to impact price somewhere?
I'll jump in again.
Okay.
Yes, there is.
Really?
However, think about the world we live in which, you know, banks are no longer held to regulatory standards that say you have to clean up bad assets. They say instead do everything you can to protect and help the homeowner. So if we get into a position where those HELOCs start to have default issues, at the end of the day, there's going to be, you know, protection for those homeowners and protection, you know, from taking those, recognizing those losses. So I don't think it's going to be an issue. Big picture, I don't think it'll be an issue. Is there an opportunity for folks who want to go after those? Will they find some folks that have fear, hit those payment crisis and the rest, and, you know, potentially do a deal? I think so. Will it impact some individuals? I absolutely think so. Will it be a big downturn? No, I don't think so.
Yeah, that was really the gist of it, was a systemic danger. Could you have enough of those to where you have a price decline on the backs of that?
Sorry, I'll take a breath.
Okay.
Can I go out on a limb?
Sure.
I'll say something controversial.
How unusual.
I don't think we ever came out of the recession.
Okay.
And so I ran this by Doug, and he didn't bless this, but I...
He's not here.
But Doug's not here, and I'm not either, but I... Outside, you know, we were standing there talking, and so here's how I equate things. And just bear with me for like 15 seconds. So I've been a pilot for 30-plus years, right? So I equate everything to flying an airplane, whether or not you, when you have altitude, you have everything, right? Don't hit the ground. It's been like you take off and you're not quite in CG, center of gravity, and the plane just won't climb. And we've been just like this for the last 6.5 years, and I cannot get this thing up and get it going. So if you put that into perspective, let me go way down in the weeds. When you talk about millennials, my kids sitting around the table wanting to buy a house, your children wanting to buy a house, first-time home buyers so people can move up, real interest rates, doesn't matter what interest rates do. Okay, forget about interest rates for a second. Think about what they are thinking about at the table, and that is their incomes aren't real, they're not going up, and they have that one thing that hangs out there, and here's the controversial statement. They have the increasing cost and fees of health care around them.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
So I'm really going to throw this out on a real huge limb, and then I'll back down, I promise. In the state of Kentucky, we have a governor that embraced Affordable Health Care Act.
Okay.
All right? Don't tense up.
We have that too.
But just think about it, how it affects everybody. They raided Medicare for $500 billion to pay for the states that did the exchanges. In Kentucky, that money runs out next year. It runs out in every state next year. Well, how are they going to pay for it? We have a governor's race coming up. They're going to pay for it by raising taxes. The average cost of health care is about $500 increase on average in Kentucky, which is not a lot of money compared to what you guys pay here in California. But think of it in perspective. That's a lot of money for somebody, a young millennial sitting around a table. It's the difference between buying a car and buying a house.
Yeah.
So you really get down in the weeds about where we're going with all this and the way people really feel about whether the economy's doing well and whether incomes are up or not, and they continue to get slammed with student loans or whatever it is and health care costs that nobody's talking about. They're not buying a car and they're not buying a house.
Mm-hmm. I had that as one of the things on talking about that. Now, when you do a loan, are you, you know, you have to put your monthly payments as if you bought a car. Do you have to put down your health care costs as an expense?
No.
No. And see, that's a bite on affordability that's under the radar, is that you do all of a sudden have to consider, well, I can't afford that because I have this. And that's a growing concern. When Doug, you had invited me back and a few other investors, Sean was with us, and talking about financing for investors. This was a long time ago. And we did absolutely no good as far as getting anybody to say, yeah, we'll go from 10 loans to 50 loans because Bruce is here or Sean's here or Tom's here.
We tried.
Yeah. And that was great. But who stepped in was the private sector. Right. So now there's billions of dollars chasing investors who have rentals or flips. And that's been a healthy thing. The interest rates have gone down for everybody. My question is, and we were back on a panel, and there was a room full of hedge funds that had raised $1 billion, and they all wanted to send it to the next group of rentals. And they're not going to find that at this point. So is there an appetite, do you think, for private funds to enter into the occupant sector of financing to where the rules may be different, and they could create programs where there are pieces missing that they could really do well? Is that possible? I don't know enough about finance to know if that vehicle is allowed even with the new rules.
Owner occupancy,
where you have, let's say, stated income loans that are for self-employed people, things like that, that we just can't seem to fund in the current environment. So
I think it is happening.
Okay.
I mean, but a lot of it's happening in the jumbo space, where the rules are somewhat different.
Okay.
Whether that happens in the conforming space, we'll see. That would be the non-QM. A lot
right.
of that you're probably talking about is a non-QM space. It depends on if the returns are sufficient for somebody to take the risk of legal action. I mean, I would argue one of the reasons that you don't see the extension of credit to the degree that you would like is there's a lot of institutions that have paid a lot of hundreds of millions of dollars in penalties, which will tell you when you go back to your shareholders, maybe we won't go all the way to the stated boundaries of the credit box, right?
Yeah.
We'll leave a little cushion. And I think that's clearly what's happening today.
Well,
so whether the private equity world enters that space, I wouldn't expect it on a large-scale basis. And the private label market is not going to come back yet, because there still has not been established a solid set of standards so that people can understand the collateral and the risks related to that collateral. I do want to support Dave's comment on consumers, though, because our headline question in our survey is the economy on the right track or the wrong track? There's only been 1 month since June of 2010 in which the majority of people thought the economy is on the right track.
Okay.
So the public is broadly doesn't believe the result.
When I look at charts of promises that we've made, we have upcoming a chart that could go vertical if we don't have more revenue or we break promises. And so real estate is one of those investments that we really have a lot of goodies. There's no place else in the world where you can make $500,000 every 2 years tax-free. 1031 exchange, millions of dollars of assets, never pay taxes until it gets to be your estate and then turns to zero. So my question is, you know, we have all these goodies, including Prop 13. There's got to be an appetite to take a look at that box and say, can we have some of those goodies? Which ones probably are too sacred to touch, and which ones do you think could go by the wayside?
The Norris Group would like to thank its gold sponsors for supporting I Survived Real Estate. Adrenaline Athletics, Coachella Valley Real Estate Investors Association, Coldwell Banker Town & Country, Elite Auctions, iMortgage, In A Day Development, Inland Valley Association of Realtors, Jennifer Buys Houses, Keller Williams Corona, Keystone CPA, Kukan & Clark, Las Brisas Escrow, L.A. South RIA, Lavis Tax Wealth Management, National RIA, Northern California Real Estate Investors Association, North San Diego Real Estate Investors, Pasadena Phoebe, Pilot Limousine, Orange County Phoebe, Real Wealth Network, Realty 411 Magazine, Resonant Lens Photography, Rick and Leanne Rossiter, Sacramento Real Estate Club, Capital City Wealth Builders, Southern California Chapter of the Appraisal Institute, Sonoka Corporation, Spinnaker Loans, Tri-Counties Association of Realtors, UDirect, IRA Services,
Weston South Coast Plaza, Wilson Investment Properties, Inc. See isurvivedrealestate.com for event video and sponsor information.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.